Welcome to Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Jessica Hergert. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by NeoGenomics, we had the pleasure of speaking with Rozelle Kurzrock, MD, Director of the Center for Personalized Cancer Therapy, Director of the Rare Tumor Clinic, and the Associate Center Director of Clinical Science at the University of California, San Diego Moores Cancer Center, and Sherry Brown, MD, Director of Molecular Pathology Services at NeoGenomics, to discuss the current role of next-generation sequencing in breast cancer. In our exclusive interview, Drs. Brown and Kurzrock discuss the current and future applications of next-generation sequencing in breast cancer, the role of tissue-based testing in light of the growing role for liquid-based testing, and some of the emerging technologies that could overcome current barriers to biomarker testing. Could you both set the stage and speak to the importance of evaluating technologies like next-generation sequencing in breast cancer?
We've made amazing strides in breast cancer, and a lot of people now have a group of breast cancer patients that are living a long time with their disease, even sometimes 10 or 20 years, but still it can be a very aggressive disease in a lot of women. And I think some of the most challenging are young women, where the disease tends to be extremely aggressive. That's the most pressing problem. These can be young women that still have young children home. Triple negative breast cancer, very difficult. Then unusual types of breast cancers, like metaplastic breast cancer, that are rarer, we know less about it. But again, I think the next generation sequencing can be tremendously important. And one of the reasons that next generation sequencing, these types of tests are so important. We know what usually happens in a specific cancer, but a lot of cancers don't actually read the publications. And there are so many exceptions to the rule. And what next generation sequencing does is it gives us a tool to know exactly what's happening in an individual patient for their benefit. And just as an example, we have a patient, triple negative breast cancer. She'd had 6 prior therapies and was really on the way to hospice. And we did a next generation sequencing test on her, and she had an extraordinarily high tumor mutational burden, 79 mutations per megabase. Now, had her breast cancer read the books, that shouldn't have happened. But nevertheless, she had this very high tumor mutational burden, and we treated her with an immune checkpoint inhibitor, in this case, nivolumab. These types of cases are very gratifying. So again, failed 6 therapies, on the way to hospice. She had an immediate response. It's now 4 years later and she's still in complete remission. I know that this is only one patient, but the ability to understand what's wrong in an individual tumor, even if it's unusual, and then the increasing ability to match patients with an appropriate drug, this really transforms the field for us.
I remember one of my instructors told me and said, we study cohorts, we treat patients. And that's the one thing about next generation sequencing. It allows us to do both. We are acquiring every patient that we test. Like I said, we did a study and presented our, 100 positive cases, the last 100 positive cases as of that date. And that was informative for everyone. But every single one of those individuals, like I said, 7 of them had resistance mutations. Those 7 patients got a different treatment than they would have gotten had they not had that test. 57 of them had positive PD-L1, that's 57 patients that for which the immunotherapy, just like the one that you mentioned, was very significant. 92%, I believe was the number, or 96% had either a targeted therapy or a clinical trial available to them because they got tested. And yeah, I love it that we're seeing more and more use in breast cancer. When I first started in molecular, it was pretty much all lung and colon. It was MSI and, you know, a few target, you know, few specific mutations. And I agree, next generation sequencing has changed the game for a lot of cancer patients.
Dr. Brown, speaking broadly, what is the current role of next generation sequencing in breast cancer? What is really the clinical need for this sort of testing?
The most important thing is there is no one size fits all, and patients are living longer and longer based on the early treatments that we're using, based on their subtypes. So their hormone receptor status and HER2 status. But for those patients down the road, as additional, as they progress or recur or if and metastasize, we need other options and more than one. So the beauty of next generation sequencing, it allows us to test a wide variety of biomarkers that have targeted therapies, clinical trials for breast cancer, as well as emerging biomarkers that could potentially benefit them currently. But we also have the ability to compile this data and use it for the future as we grow and develop new treatments for patients in the future. Specifically, I'm impressed by the tests that do prognostic significance in patients with early disease, because that's really helpful. It's lucky when we find or make a diagnosis in the early stage. That's the best possibility for the patient. But it also, you know, when you're at like stage two and, you know, or maybe one local lymph node that's involved, you have this question about, do you want to use a systemic therapy or how long do you want to keep the patient on a hormonal therapy? And the ability to do these gene expression profiles by next generation sequencing, I think has a huge benefit. So I see the benefit of these types of testing for all different stages, as well as family members. When we identify genomic profile in a patient, we suspect is inherited disease playing a part, and particularly in patients who are diagnosed at an early age. And this ability to, you know, to test a variety of things that not just impact this specific patient in terms of treatment and prognosis and other things, but to determine, you know, what is the underlying cause of this patient's disease, and if their, you know, sisters, brothers, children are affected. And also, you know, what's their risk of cancers in other systems? Are they also at risk of an ovarian cancer or a pancreatic tumor? And so those things are really helpful to know, because we need to not just do mammograms. We need to do other types of surveillance for those specific patients. So I think it just brings a lot of things to benefit the patient that we just didn't have 10 years ago.
Dr. Brown, could you discuss the differences between percentage of cases of next generation sequencing testing in lung versus breast cancer?
So that's a great question. I think there's a couple of factors at play. So one, lung cancer, you know, we recognize early on that there was, you know, genomic profiles that are specific to lung cancer, whereas we were subtyping breast cancers based on hormone receptor therapy. And because of it's a different type of way to detect that, so the molecular test, which is a little bit more specialized, as opposed to the immunohistochemistry testing. And almost every pathologist in the country works in, even the smallest labs and the smallest hospitals will have at least a few immuno stains. And ER/PR are among the most commonly utilized, and HER2, CISH and ISH now very, very common in the local setting. And so those were so easy to perform in breast cancer, and a lot of our treatment therapies were targeted for those. So I think the genomic profiling for breast cancer kind of lagged behind because we had a viable alternative. Whereas in lung cancer, it really was EGFR and a couple of other things. The simple receptor, you know, or anything that we could have done by immunohistochemistry was not available for lung cancer. So I think that's one of the reasons that lung cancer made huge leap ahead in terms of the molecular area. But we are seeing great deal of activity and progress in recent years in breast cancer, as we've outlined in this presentation. And I expect to see a lot more going forward. The targeted therapy, alpelisib or Piqray, that's the companion, we perform the companion diagnostic for that test. And we know that that's a significant game changer for a lot of HER2 negative cancers. And so those types of things I see as we build more progress on those successes, that we'll continue to see more over the coming years.
Dr. Kurzrock, what key biomarkers are you looking out for when you're utilizing next generation sequencing? And what are some of the key emerging biomarkers on the horizon?
Yeah, so I think this is a really very rapidly moving field. And Dr. Brown has alluded to some of them, but I just want to review what I think some of the most important ones. Of course, PIK3CA. With Piqray. Immunotherapy applies to only a subset of patients, but it's really important. So microsatellite status, high tumor mutational burden, high PD-L1, of course, HER2 or ERBB2 amplification, and rare alterations like NTRK fusions or NTRK abnormalities. But in addition to these, which really are important for FDA-approved drugs, there's just an enormous number of alterations that are being studied in clinical trials, and also alterations that may be relevant and are emerging as being relevant to resistance. So I'll just give you a few examples of genomic alterations that are emerging as important. We know that some patients that are ER positive are resistant to estrogen receptor modulation. And so now we can look also, this is emerging for ESR, which is basically ER mutations. And specific mutations will emerge and make the tumor resistant to virtually all hormonal modulation. Other mutations may make the tumor resistant to specific hormone modulators, but they may still be sensitive to fulvestrant, as an example, which downregulates the estrogen receptor. And then other alterations, I'll just give you one more example. We've talked a lot about HER2. And we've been treating HER2 positive patients that have underlying amplification and they're positive by immunohistochemistry with HER2 targeting agents for years. But it's there's a lot of literature that is now emerging that some HER2 negative patients, negative on IHC, may also be responsive. And in some cases, they're responsive because they have a mutation in HER2 or ERBB2, which is HER2. So this mutation doesn't cause an increase in expression of HER2, which you would see in IHC, but it causes an activation of the receptor, which is just as important in driving the tumor as overexpression. But the IHC is just not going to show it. So next generation sequencing can pick up, and I've had several of these patients, they're IHC negative, but they have an activating mutation. And some of these patients can have really remarkable responses to HER2 targeting agents. So I think it's the array of genes that you get with next generation sequencing, but it's also getting a deeper understanding of individual genes, even genes that we know about, like estrogen receptor and HER2, and understanding exactly what is going on in those genes that may make the patient resistant, and therefore we should not give the therapy, or may make the patient sensitive, and therefore we should give the therapy, even if maybe the IHC doesn't show, as I gave you an example, HER2 overexpression.
Dr. Brown, how do you foresee minimal residual disease playing a role in breast cancer going forward?
No, it's an excellent question, and it's becoming more and more commonplace to test for minimal residual disease in solid tumor. We've been doing it in heme diseases for a long time, But with the increased use of liquid biopsy, it makes it easier. So what we're talking about is looking for cell-free DNA or tumor-specific circulating tumor DNA in the plasma portion of the blood. And this allows us to test, you know, with basically a blood draw, which is considerably easier than doing an invasive CT-guided biopsy. As I mentioned, you know, not, you know, it's often easier to do look for testing with breast, but, you know, we've got mammograms and a couple of other ways that make it a little bit easier for us to continue to monitor a patient with breast cancer as opposed to lung cancer. But what if they have a distant metastasis? Then that might not be something that we would detect with a mammogram as a possible method of surveillance. So liquid biopsy offers, you know, high sensitivity for a patient where we have known biomarkers to look for that patient's signs, cell-free DNA of that specific mutation profile that is known in this patient. PIK3CA is a great example. We can do liquid biopsy for that single target. And that's one way to perform it. There are liquid biopsy panels. Some are pan-cancer, and they have specific alterations that are detected in breast cancer. And so if you have one of the mutations that is on a liquid biopsy panel, then that liquid biopsy panel will be useful to you. You specifically mentioned RaDaR, which we're bringing forward. Now, the RaDaR is a unique minimal residual disease assay. It actually takes the patient's tumor, performs whole exome sequencing on that of the alterations that are detected. An algorithm is used to predict which mutations in the patient's tumor are most indicative of their cancer, most likely to be seen, that are present in a high value or a high variant allele frequency. And then a test is basically personalized for Mrs. Smith's breast cancer versus Mr. Jones's lung cancer. And so when we want to follow up on Mrs. Smith, we know which specific mutations are in her tumor, and we look for those specific alterations in the blood. So it is the height of personalized medicine, and we are looking forward to that being used to follow a lot of cancer patients in the future.
Dr. Kurzrock, could you speak to the role of tissue-based testing in the context of the growing role for liquid-based testing?
This is a really important question, and I think the future is a little bit hard to predict, but what we know today is that tissue-based testing and liquid-based testing are complementary. And one of the things that sometimes bothers people when they do a blood test versus a tissue test is that the results aren't exactly the same. You know, 80% of the abnormalities seen or 85% are the same, and then about 15% differ. This has raised the question that one or the other test may be incorrect. But I think the data shows that both tests are correct, but they are giving complementary data, and that we shouldn't expect the same answer from both tests. So the tissue is sort of limited because it gives you the answer in that small piece of tissue that you biopsied. So you biopsied a piece of the liver, you know what's in the liver metastases. You don't really know what's in the lung metastases, which probably have a lot in common with the liver metastases, but they may not be exactly the same. Now, you do a blood-based test, and now you may be looking at shed DNA from multiple metastatic sites. And so you're going to get a result that has much in common with the tissue-based test, but it also may have some different alterations because you're not just looking at shed DNA from the liver, you're also looking at shed DNA from the lung. On the other hand, the liquid biopsy still has some significant downsides as well. It's an amazing technology, but it's still picking up very small amounts of DNA. And if the tumor burden is not very high, the liquid biopsy may not pick up any abnormalities, whereas you're going to see those abnormalities in the tissue biopsy. Also, the liquid biopsy, the amount of the mutation, or if you see it, may be influenced by therapy. Now, that can be a good thing in that you can follow and eventually do serial liquid biopsies to see if your therapy is working. But on the other hand, it can be a downside because you may not see important alterations in the liquid biopsy because they've been somewhat suppressed below the threshold where you can detect them, but they're still driving the tumor. And therefore, you need the tissue biopsy to be able to see those alterations. So again, I think the future, this field has moved so amazingly fast that it's really hard to say what's going to be true in 10 or 20 years. For now and for the immediate future, to me, both tissue and liquid biopsies are critically important. They give you different information. They give you some of the same information, but they also give you different information because they're biologically assessing different aspects of the tumor, and we need both.
Now, Dr. Brown, how are you currently going about tailoring next-generation sequencing to specific patients? What characteristics are you using to make the selection, and how can this tailored approach translate to the community setting?
Well, it's challenging to stay up on the literature, and it's challenging to stay up with the NCCN guidelines. As I mentioned, the science is advancing so quickly. So we have a team of people, and we are always reading and always checking NCCN guideline updates. We are always checking up on, you know, the recent clinical trials. Because a significant portion of our business is in the biopharma sector, we're kind of aware of a lot of things and new things that are being developed. And so that helps us predict, you know, what genes and what types of tests to add. But as you mentioned, like you have to tailor it for every patient. And so we have situations where maybe the patient has a history of breast cancer, but their metastasis is poorly differentiated, and they can't say for sure that it is a metastasis from the patient's previous breast cancer. And so we have to treat that specific patient with kind of both arms. We have to recognize that it's probably a high likelihood that it is the patient's previous breast cancer. It's just in the metastatic state, it's poorly differentiated because tumors, you know, either lose specific differentiating markers when they advance to the point or progress to the point that they can metastasize, and they just become a little bit harder to pick out and identify. And so we know statistically that patient's likely to have a breast cancer, but we also have to recognize that it could be something else. And so we're always looking at, you know, what's the most likely, what other things could be done. We rely heavily because we're a reference lab. So we rely heavily on what information we can get from the pathologist who made the initial diagnosis. And so we pore over the reports. We sometimes have other types of tests that we can bring in and help us make decisions. And sometimes we recognize things that'll suggest that, you know, we want follow-up or we want additional testing added. So in the case of breast cancer, we often see, you know, because we're testing tumor, we're not testing normal tissue, but we see mutations all the time, not just in BRCA1 and 2, but in other genes as well that we see, you know, we look at the tumor content and it's maybe about 40%. All the other mutations of interest show up at about 20% variant allele frequency in the testing. But we see some mutations that stand out at approximately 50% variant allele frequency. So we may think that that particular alteration in this particular patient might be a germline mutation. And so in those specific cases, we recommend a consult with a genetic provider, either a geneticist or a genetic counselor who can review their history. You know, we always look and check the patient's age, you know, and sometimes I look and, you know, it's a man's name and maybe it's a male breast cancer. And so those particular, in those particular interests, you know, you want to make sure that they're getting all the relevant testing in terms of their potential germline alterations that are going to impact their therapy for this specific disease, but also, you know, the surveillance that they need to have for other potential diseases, pancreatic cancers, ovarian cancers, et cetera. And also that make sure that they get their family members tested if there are other people that could be at risk. So those are, you know, constant that we use when we're looking at specific patients.
Dr. Kurzrock, Could you highlight some of the current barriers that need to be overcome with regard to biomarker testing in breast cancer? What technologies are emerging that may overcome some of these barriers?
That's a really interesting question. Some of the barriers are not necessarily technological barriers, but maybe training barriers. And this is a really complicated field that has emerged very, very quickly. And I know even in our fellowship programs, our fellows are not, in my view, adequately or sometimes at all trained in molecular medicine. And yet genomics is becoming a basis of diagnosis, prognosis, and treating many cancers. So I think training is a big barrier. It's not a technologic barrier, but I think having that comfort with it, with these technologies and what they mean, that challenge really needs to be met, both for new doctors, new oncologists, and also for existing oncologists. And it's moving fast. So it's not a one-time, we'll teach you about this. I think this podcast has really given a lot of information, but I don't think this is a one-time deal because the field is moving really quickly. So then as far as technologies, there's really a lot happening on the technology. And I'll just mention a couple of things. Next generation sequencing is about DNA, but RNA, the expression levels are emerging as more and more important. They're important for finding certain genomic abnormalities like fusions, but just simply the expression levels. In some of our research studies, we've shown how important they are. And RNA has been technically more difficult to assess. And I think that's why it hasn't as emerged in the clinic as strongly as DNA. But I think RNA is one of the next frontiers, one of the next areas where we're going to look at this in a clinical grade manner to understand expression and really understand what this means to individual patients. And then the last one that I'll mention, which is something that I feel is extraordinarily important, and that's immune markers. So immunotherapy has just emerged on the scene and transformed oncology. And I think we've hit the low-hanging fruit with the anti-PD-1, anti-PD-L1 drugs. And I think that there's now 7 of them approved. And then anti-CTLA-4, a smaller niche. There are literally dozens of drugs that are immunotherapy drugs that are in development and are in clinical trials. And I think I saw one paper that estimated that we're going to need almost 400,000 patients to fill all the clinical trial slots. So really, people are really excited about this. But I think what is really important to learn is the lesson from genomics. I think we pretty much understand now that if you don't have the genomic target, your chance of responding to the drug is much lower. With immunotherapy, the low-hanging fruit with the initial checkpoint inhibitors, I think almost has obscured that lesson. And I think if we're really going to be able to properly exploit all the other immunotherapy drugs, which probably apply to a small subset of patients, we're going to need to have the right tests to understand which patient gets which drug, just like we do for targeted therapy. So for me, that's a really important next generation type of assay.
So in both of your opinions, what's next for biomarker identification? What are you really keeping your eye on that could have clinical implications for practicing oncologists?
I think I've mentioned some of the technological and the training hurdles, but the most important point that I want to make relates back to that idea of studying cohorts, but treating individual patients. not too long ago, we had to make decisions about what drug we were going to give patients based on population averages. And that's how our clinical trials worked. So if 30% of patients responded, that drug got FDA approved, and we would give the drug, and it would be, you know, great drug for 30% of patients, and then pretty useless for the other 70% of patients. But we didn't have any tools to be able to differentiate which patients, or to be able to differentiate really well which patients would be the responders versus the resistant patients. I think what these tools like next generation sequencing allow us to do is really move into the realm of individualized medicine, where I can say to the patient sitting in front of me, I'm going to be able to understand the biology of your tumor. And I don't really care what happens in another 1,000 patients. I care about your tumor and treating your tumor. So the technology isn't perfect yet, but it's really moved rapidly and really allows us to be able to match each patient with the right drugs for that patient, rather than making decisions based on what we did before, which was really educated guesses and population averages. I think we're really going to go away from that to firm data on individual patients. And that's where this technology has led us and is leading us.
That's well said. I certainly agree with all of those things, and I'm excited to see how our science advances oncology and how oncology advances molecular as they give and take back and forth and inform each other. Some other things that I've noticed in our field that aren't really definitely being applied to breast cancer yet, but I'm optimistic that there will be some applications for them. You know, next generation sequencing has made huge advances, and there's other things that we're noticing in other tumor types that might be relevant in breast cancer as well. And one of those is like methylation testing and the what we call the methylome. It's used a lot for cancer screening right now, and it's starting to be used specifically in other organ systems for both diagnosis and staging. I can cite the WHO Blue Book for CNS tumors comes out, and that actually includes methylation for several of the tumor types. And it's actually a lot of, I've been reading up on some of the methylation profiles are so accurate that they can predict which mutations are present in the patient just based on the methylation profile. So that's pretty powerful. It's not going to replace those testing, but in the short term, but it could potentially be a one test that if the prediction of the which genes are involved are that accurate, it could be a possibility we have this one test that can do all of those things. And it's, you know, next generation sequencing based. So I'm keeping an eye on that. I'm also looking at other things. I'm, you know, very interested in tumor heterogeneity. And in some cases of the tumor, we're in breast cancer tumor, we know there's tumor heterogeneity among the primary tumors and metastatic lesions. We know that like progressive lesions can change hormone receptor and HER2 status as they acquire and certainly can acquire new mutations when they move from a localized lesion to a metastatic lesion. But we're not really in tune to the primary tumor and the heterogeneity within the tumor. We know there's heterogeneity, but we don't know how to test it right now or what to look at. And so there's some new technologies on the horizon for single cell sequencing applications that would allow us to do like basically kind of how immunohistochemistry is done, where we can see the difference within the tumor of certain areas of the tumor. And so I'm very interested in that. Other things that I wonder if there could be an application in breast cancer are what's called digital biomarkers. So these are used a lot more for like heart disease, diabetes, and things like that. But now we know cancer patients, particularly breast cancer patients that are on hormone therapy for a long period of time, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could have mechanisms where you could monitor a patient in real time. There's so many apps on the phone that are available with things now. And I lost my pancreas because most of my pancreas because of a pancreatic tumor a couple of years ago. I'm now diabetic. So I wear a scanner, a glucose monitor constantly. And every time I plug that in, I think, wow, what can we do with that for liquid biopsy? What can we do with that for drug toxicity monitoring? What other applications could we use? I mean, if it can sense glucose, why can't it sense some of these other things that we want to monitor in the plasma? And I just think we're going to see a total paradigm shift in the next 10 to 20 years in how we treat patients and the ability to like closely monitor and detect changes early before, you know, before they're evident by a CT scan or, you know, a breast exam, mammogram, or some of these other type of methods that we're using. So I'm a technological junkie. I a real nerd out on these types of technology. So I'm really interested to see where they lead us.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Enclave on Air, sponsored by NeoGenomics. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and institutional perspectives in cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Enclave and at Enclave SOSS. On Facebook, like us at Enclave and Enclave State of the Science Summit, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Enclave on Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave on Air.